from the inside out. In order to make all go well, if you are considering hiring a senior person, do not chase an abstract rationale like adult supervision or becoming a real company. A weak definition of what you are looking for will lead to a bad outcome. The proper reason to hire a senior person is to acquire knowledge and experience in a specific area. For example, as a technical founder, you probably do not have terrific knowledge of how to build a worldwide sales channel, how to create an invincible brand, or how to identify and negotiate ecosystem-altering business development deals. Acquiring a world-class senior person can dramatically accelerate your company's ability to succeed in these areas. One good test for determining whether to go with outside experience versus internal promotion is to figure out whether you value inside knowledge or outside knowledge more for the position. For example, for engineering managers, the comprehensive knowledge of the code base and engineering team is usually more important and difficult to acquire than knowledge of how to run scalable engineering organizations. As a result, you might very well value the knowledge of your own organization more than that of the outside world. In hiring someone to sell your product to large enterprises, the opposite is true. Knowing how your target customers think and operate, knowing their cultural tendencies, understanding how to recruit and measure the right people in the right regions of the world to maximize your sales, these things turn out to be far more valuable than knowing your own company's product and culture. This is why when the head of engineering gets promoted from within, she often succeeds. When the head of sales gets promoted from within, she almost always fails. Asking yourself, "Do I value internal or external knowledge more for this position?" will help you determine whether to go for experience or youth. Once they arrive, bringing senior people on board can be fraught with peril, as I have outlined in the sections, why it's hard to bring big company execs into little companies, and hiring executives. If you've never done the job, how do you hire somebody good? Equally difficult is managing them effectively once they come on board. Senior people pose several important challenges. They come with their own culture. They will bring the habits, the communication style, and values from the company they grew up in. It's very unlikely these will match your environment exactly. They will know how to work the system. Because senior people come from larger environments, they usually develop the skills to navigate and be effective in those environments. These skills may seem political and unusual in your environment. You don't know the job as well as they do. In fact, you are hiring them precisely because you don't know how to do the job. So how do you hold them accountable for doing a good job? In order to prevent the internal degeneration mentioned earlier, it's important to be aware of the above issues and then employ appropriate countermeasures to make sure they don't metastasize. First, you should demand cultural compliance. It's fine that people come from other company cultures. It's true that some of those cultures will have properties that are superior to your own. But this is your company, your culture, and your way of doing business. Do not be intimidated by experience on this issue. Stick to your guns and stick to your culture. If you want to expand your culture to incorporate some of the new thinking, that's fine, but do so explicitly. Do not drift. Next, watch for politically motivated tactics and do not tolerate them. Perhaps most important, set a high and clear standard for performance. If you want to have a world-class company, you must make sure that the people on your staff, be they young or old, are world-class. It is not nearly enough that someone in your staff can do the job better than you can, because you are incompetent at the job. That's why you hired them in the first place. Be careful not to set a low bar because you have not done the work to know what good is. For example, I've seen many a young CEO excited about her company's competency in marketing and PR because she got a bunch of positive stories on her launch. That's not a high PR standard. Anybody can get reporters to write nice things about a sweet, cuddly baby of a company. Only world-class PR people can deal with gangly, pimple-ridden teenage companies. World-class PR people can turn around negative stories. World-class PR people can turn chicken shit into chicken salad. Turning chicken shit into chicken salad requires long-term, trusted relationships, deep know-how, and the confidence to make use of both appropriately. PR kids don't have any of the three. One excellent way to develop a high standard is to interview people who you see doing a great job in their field. Find out what their standard is and add it to your own. Once you determine a high yet achievable performance bar, hold your executive to that high standard, even if you have no idea how they might achieve it. It's not your job to figure out how to create an incredible brand, tilt the playing field by cutting a transformational deal, or achieve a sales goal that nobody thought possible. That's what you are paying them to do. That's why you hired them. Finally, you'll need your new executive to be more than just a goal achiever. She will need to be well-rounded and part of the team. Bill Campbell developed an excellent methodology for measuring executives in a balanced way that will help you achieve this. He breaks performance down into four distinct areas. 1. Results against objectives. Once you've set a high standard, it will be straightforward to measure your executive against that standard. 2. Management. Even if an executive does a superb job achieving her goals, that doesn't mean she is building a strong and loyal team. It's important to understand how well she is managing, even if she is hitting her goals. 3. Innovation. It's quite possible for an executive to hit her goal for the quarter by ignoring the future. For example, a great way for an engineering manager to hit her goals for features and dates is by building a horrible architecture, which won't even support the next release. This is why you must look beyond the black box results and into the sausage factory to see how things get made. 4. Working with peers. This may not be intuitive at first, but executives must be effective at communicating, supporting, and getting what they need from the other people on your staff. Evaluate them along this dimension. Oh man, you sold your soul. Hiring the first senior people into your company may feel like selling your soul. And if you are not careful, you may well end up selling the soul of your company. But if you want to make something from nothing, you have to take risks and you have to win your race against time. This means acquiring the very best talent, knowledge, and experience, even if it requires dealing with some serious age diversity. One-on-one. After I first wrote about one-on-ones, people flooded me with feedback about one-on-ones. About half the responders chastised me, saying that one-on-ones were useless and that I shouldn't put so much emphasis on them. The other half wanted to know how to run more effective one-on-ones. It seems to me that both groups are likely talking about two sides of the same coin. Perhaps the CEO's most important operational responsibility is designing and implementing the communication architecture for her company. The architecture might include the organizational design, meetings, processes, email, Yammer, and even one-on-one meetings with managers and employees. Absent a well-designed communication architecture, information and ideas will stagnate, and your company will degenerate into a bad place to work. While it is quite possible to design a great communication architecture without one-on-one meetings, in most cases, one-on-ones provide an excellent mechanism for information and ideas to flow up the organization and should be part of your design. Generally, people who think one-on-one meetings are a bad idea have been victims of poorly designed ones. The key to a good one-on-one meeting is the understanding that it is the employee's meeting rather than the manager's meeting. This is the free-form meeting for all the pressing issues, brilliant ideas, and chronic frustrations that do not fit neatly into status reports, email, and other less personal and intimate mechanisms. If you are an employee, how do you get feedback from your manager on an exciting but only 20% formed idea that you're not sure is relevant without sounding like a fool? How do you point out that a colleague you do not know how to work with is blocking your progress without throwing her under the bus? How do you get help when you love your job, but your personal life is melting down? Through a status report? On email? Yammer? Asana? Really? For these and other important areas of discussions, one-on-ones can be essential. If you like structured agendas, then the employee should set the agenda. A good practice is to have the employee send you the agenda in advance. This will give her a chance to cancel the meeting if nothing is pressing. It also makes clear that it is her meeting and will take as much or as little time as she needs. During the meeting, since it's the employee's meeting, the manager should do 10% of the talking and 90% of the listening. Note that this is the opposite of most one-on-ones. While it's not the manager's job to set the agenda or do the talking, the manager should try to draw the key issues out of the employee. The more introverted the employee, the more important this becomes. If you manage engineers, drawing out issues will be an important skill to master. Some questions that I found to be very effective in one-on-ones. If we could improve in any way, how would we do it? What's the number one problem with our organization? Why? What's not fun about working here? Who is really kicking ass in the company? Whom do you admire? If you were me, what changes would you make? What don't you like about the product? What's the biggest opportunity that we're missing out on? What are we not doing that we should be doing? Are you happy working here? In the end, the most important thing is that the best ideas, the biggest problems, and the most intense employee life issues make their way to the people who can deal with them. One-on-ones are a time-tested way to do that. But if you have a better one, go ahead with your bad self. Programming your culture. Ask 10 founders about company culture and what it means, and you'll get 10 different answers. It's about office design. It's about screening out the wrong kinds of employees. It's about values. It's about fun. It's about alignment. It's about finding like-minded employees. It's about being cult-like. So what is culture? Does culture matter? If so, how much time should you spend on it? Let's start with the second question first. The primary thing that any technology startup must do is build a product that's at least 10 times better at doing something than the current prevailing way of doing that thing. 2 or 3 times better will not be good enough to get people to switch to the new thing fast enough or in large enough volume to matter. The second thing that any technology startup must do is to take the market. If it's possible to do something 10 times better, it's also possible that you won't be the only company to figure that out. Therefore, you must take the market before somebody else does. Very few products are 10 times better than the competition's, so unseating the new incumbent is much more difficult than unseating the old one. If you fail to do both of those things, your culture won't matter one bit. The world is full of bankrupt companies with world-class cultures. Culture does not make a company, so why bother with culture at all? 3 reasons. 1. It matters to the extent that it can help you achieve the above goals. 2. As your company grows, culture can help you preserve your key values, make your company a better place to work, and help it perform better in the future. 3. Perhaps most important, after you and your people go through the inhuman amount of work that it will take to build a successful company, it will be an epic tragedy if your company culture is such that even you don't want to work there. Creating a company culture. When I refer to company culture, I'm not referring to other important activities like company values and employee satisfaction. Specifically, I am writing about designing a way of working that will distinguish you from competitors, ensure that critical operating values persist, such as delighting customers or making beautiful products, help you identify employees who fit with your mission. Culture means lots of other things in other contexts, but the above will be plenty to discuss here. When you start implementing your culture, keep in mind that most of what will be retrospectively referred to as your company's culture will not have been designed into the system, but rather will have evolved over time based on your behavior and the behavior of your early employees. As a result, you will want to focus on a small number of cultural design points that will influence a large number of behaviors over a long period of time. In his best-selling book, Built to Last, Jim Collins wrote that one of the things that long-lasting companies he studied have in common is a cult-like culture. I found this description to be confusing because it seems to imply that as long as your culture is weird enough and you are rabid enough about it, you will succeed on the cultural front. That's related to the truth, but not actually true. In reality, Collins was right that a properly designed culture often ends up looking cult-like in retrospect, but that's not the initial design principle. You needn't think hard about how you can make your company seem bizarre to outsiders. However, you do need to think about how you can be provocative enough to change what people do every day. Ideally, a cultural design point will be trivial to implement, but have far-reaching behavioral consequences. Key to this kind of mechanism is shock value. If you put something into your culture that is so disturbing that it always creates a conversation, it will change behavior. As we learned in The Godfather, ask a Hollywood mogul to give someone a job, and he might not respond. Put a horse's head in his bed, and unemployment will drop by one. Shock is a great mechanism for behavioral change. Here are three examples. Desks made out of doors. Very early on, Jeff Bezos, founder and CEO of Amazon.com, envisioned a company that made money by delivering value to, rather than extracting value from, its customers. In order to do that, he wanted to be both the price leader and customer service leader for the long run. You can't do that if you waste a lot of money. Jeff could have spent years auditing every expense and raining hell on anybody who overspent, but he decided to build frugality into his culture. He did it with an incredibly simple mechanism. All desks at Amazon.com for all time would be built by buying cheap doors from Home Depot and nailing legs to them. These door desks are not great ergonomically, nor do they fit with Amazon.com's $150 billion plus market capitalization. But when a shocked new employee asks why she must work on a makeshift desk constructed out of random Home Depot parts, the answer comes back with withering consistency. We look for every opportunity to save money so that we can deliver the best products for the lowest cost. If you don't like sitting at a door, then you won't last long at Amazon. $10 per minute. When we started Andreessen Horowitz, Mark and I wanted the firm to treat entrepreneurs with great respect. We remembered how psychologically brutal the process of building a company was. We wanted the firm to respect the fact that in the bacon and egg breakfast of a startup, we were with the chicken and the entrepreneur was the pig. We were involved, but she was committed. We thought that one way to communicate respect would be to always be on time to meetings with entrepreneurs. Rather than make them wait in our lobby for 30 minutes while we attended to more important business, like so many venture capitalists that we visited, we wanted our people to be on time, prepared, and focused. Unfortunately, anyone who has ever worked anywhere knows that this is easier said than done. In order to shock the company into the right behavior, we instituted a ruthlessly enforced $10 per minute fine for being late to a meeting with an entrepreneur. So, for example, you are on a really important call and will be 10 minutes late. No problem. Just bring $100 to the meeting and pay your fine. When new employees come on board, they find this shocking, which gives us a great opportunity to explain in detail why we respect entrepreneurs. If you don't think entrepreneurs are more important than venture capitalists, we can't use you at Andreessen Horowitz. Move fast and break things. Mark Zuckerberg believes in innovation, and he believes there can be no great innovation without great risk. So in the early days of Facebook, he deployed a shocking motto, move fast and break things. Did the CEO really want us to break things? I mean, he's telling us to break things. A motto that shocking forces everyone to stop and think. When they think, they realize that if you move fast and innovate, you will break things. If you ask yourself, should I attempt this breakthrough? It will be awesome, but it may cause problems in the short term. You have your answer. If you'd rather be right than innovative, you won't fit in at Facebook. Prior to figuring out the exact form of your company's shock therapy, be sure that your mechanism agrees with your values. For example, Jack Dorsey will never make his own desks out of doors at Square, because at Square, beautiful design trumps frugality. When you walk in a Square, you can feel how seriously they take design. Why dogs at work and yoga aren't culture. Startups today do all kinds of things to distinguish themselves. Many great, many original, many quirky, but most of them will not define the company's culture. Yes, yoga may make your company a better place to work for people who like yoga. It may also be a great team-building exercise for people who like yoga. Nonetheless, it's not culture. It will not establish a core value that drives the business and helps promote it in perpetuity. It is not specific with respect to what your business aims to achieve. Yoga is a perk. Somebody keeping a pit bull in her cube may be shocking. The lesson learned, that animal lovers are welcome or that employees can live however they want, may provide some societal value, but it does not connect to your business in a distinguishing way. Every smart company values its employees. Perks are good, but they are not culture. The point of it all. In the later section, How to Evaluate CEOs, I describe the CEO job as knowing what to do and getting the company to do what you want. Designing a proper company culture will help you get your company to do what you want in certain important areas for a very long time. Taking the mystery out of scaling a company. If you want to build an important company, then at some point, you have to scale. People in startup land often talk about the magic of how few people built the original Google or the original Facebook, but today's Google employs 20,000 people, and today's Facebook employs more than 1,500 people. So, if you want to do something that matters, then you're going to have to learn the black art of scaling a human organization. Often board members give entrepreneurs two bits of advice regarding scale. One, get a mentor. Two, find some been there, done that executives who already know how to scale. These answers, while fine as far as they go, have some important limitations. First, if you don't know anything about scaling an organization, then it will be very difficult for you to evaluate people for that job. Imagine trying to find a killer engineer if you'd never written a single program. Second, many investor board members don't know anything about scaling a company either, and can be suckers for people who have the experience, but not the skills. If you've ever worked in a large organization, you know that there are plenty of people with experience running them, but none of the requisite skills to run them well. This advice is still good, but the right way to pick both the best mentors and best employees is by first learning the basics. Then you can apply the myriad of scaling techniques in management literature depending on the context. The basic idea. Give ground grudgingly. When an organization grows in size, things that were previously easy become difficult. Specifically, the following things that cause no trouble when you were small become big challenges as you grow. Communication. Common knowledge. Decision-making. In order to get a clear understanding of the problem, let's start with a boundary condition. Imagine a company of one employee. That employee writes and tests all the code, does all the marketing and sales, and manages herself. She has complete knowledge of everything in the company, makes all the decisions, needn't communicate with anyone, and is totally aligned with herself. As the company grows, things will only get worse in each dimension. On the other hand, if the company doesn't expand, then it will never be much of a company. So the challenge is to grow, but degrade as slowly as possible. There's a great analog to this concept in American football. An offensive lineman's job is to protect the quarterback from onrushing defensive linemen. If the offensive lineman attempts to do this by holding his ground, the defensive lineman will easily run around him and crush the quarterback. As a result, offensive linemen are taught to lose the battle slowly or to give ground grudgingly. They're taught to back up and allow the defensive lineman to advance, but just a little at a time. When you scale an organization, you will also need to give ground grudgingly. Specialization, organizational structure, and process all complicate things, and implementing them will feel like you are moving away from common knowledge and quality communication. It is very much like the offensive lineman taking a step backward. You will lose ground, but you will prevent your company from descending into chaos. How to do it. At the point when adding people into the company feels like more work than the work you can offload to the new employees, the defensive lineman has run around you, and you probably need to start giving ground grudgingly. Specialization, The first scale technique to implement is specialization. In startups, everybody starts out as a jack of all trades. For example, engineers write code, manage the build system, test the product, and increasingly deploy it and operate it. This works well in the beginning because everybody knows everything, and the need to communicate is minimized. There are no complicated handoffs because there's nobody to hand anything to. As the company grows, it becomes increasingly difficult to add new engineers because the learning curve starts to get super steep. Getting a new engineer up to speed starts to become more difficult than doing the work yourself. At this point, you need to specialize. By dedicating people and teams to such tasks as the build environment, the test environment, and operations, you will create some complexity. Handoffs across groups, potentially conflicting agendas, and specialized rather than common knowledge. In order to mitigate these issues, you will need to consider other scale techniques, like organizational design and process. Organizational design. The first rule of organizational design is that all organizational designs are bad. With any design, you will optimize communication among some parts of the organization at the expense of other parts. For example, if you put product management in the engineering organization, you will optimize communication between product management and engineering at the expense of communication between product management and marketing. As a result, as soon as you roll out the new organization, people will find fault with it, and they will be right. Nonetheless, at some point, the monolithic design of one huge organization runs out of gas, and you will need to split things into smaller subgroups. At the most basic level, you'll want to consider giving the groups that you've specialized their own managers as they grow. You may want a QA manager, for example. After that, things become more complex. Do client engineering and server engineering have their own groups, or do you organize by use cases and include all technical components? When you get really big, you'll need to decide whether to organize the entire company around functions. For example, sales, marketing, product management, engineering, or around missions. Self-contained business units that contain multiple functions. Your goal is to choose the least of all evils. Think of the organizational design as the communications architecture for your company. If you want people to communicate, the best way to accomplish that is to make them report to the same manager. By contrast, the further away people are in the organizational chart, the less they will communicate. The organizational design is also the architecture for how the company communicates with the outside world. For example, you might want to organize your sales force by product to maximize communication with the relevant product groups and maximize the product competency of the sales force. If you do that, then you will do so at the expense of simplicity for customers who buy multiple products and will now have to deal with multiple salespeople. With this in mind, here are the basic steps to organizational design. 1. Figure out what needs to be communicated. Start by listing the most important knowledge and who needs to have it. For example, knowledge of the product architecture must be understood by engineering, QA, product management, marketing, and sales. 2. Figure out what needs to be decided. Consider the types of decisions that must get made on a frequent basis. Feature selection, architectural decisions, how to resolve support issues. How can you design the organization to put the maximum number of decisions under the domain of a designated manager? 3. Prioritize the most important communication and decision paths. Is it more important for product managers to understand the product architecture or the market? Is it more important for engineers to understand the customer or the architecture? Keep in mind that these priorities will be based on today's situation. If the situation changes, then you can reorganize. 4. Decide who's going to run each group. Notice that this is the fourth step, not the first. You want to optimize the organization for the people doing the work, not for the managers. Most large mistakes in organizational design come from putting the individual ambitions of the people at the top of the organization ahead of the communication paths for the people at the bottom of the organization. Making this step 4 will upset your managers, but they will get over it. 5. Identify the paths that you did not optimize. As important as picking the communication paths that you will optimize is identifying the ones that you will not. Just because you deprioritize them doesn't mean they are unimportant. If you ignore them entirely, they will surely come back to bite you. 6. Build a plan for mitigating the issues identified in step 5. Once you've identified the likely issues, you will know the processes you will need to build to patch the impending cross-organizational challenges. These 6 steps should get you pretty far. When we examine advanced organizational design, we also need to consider trade-offs, such as speed versus cost, how to roll out organizational changes, and how often you should reorganize. Process. The purpose of process is communication. If there are 5 people in your company, you don't need process, because you can just talk to each other. You can hand off tasks with a perfect understanding of what's expected. You pass important information from one person to another, and you can maintain high-quality transactions with no bureaucratic overhead. With 4,000 people, communication becomes more difficult. Ad hoc, point-to-point communication no longer works. You need something more robust. A communication bus, or, to use the conventional term for human communication buses, a process. A process is a formal, well-structured communication vehicle. It can be a heavily engineered Six Sigma process, or it can be a well-structured regular meeting. The size of the process should be scaled up or down to meet the needs of the communication challenge that it facilitates. When communication in an organization spans across organizational boundaries, processes will help ensure that the communication happens and that it happens with quality. If you are looking for the first process to implement in your company, consider the interview process. It usually runs across organizational boundaries, the hiring group, human resources, or wherever the recruiter lives, and supporting groups, involves people from outside the company, the candidate, and is critically important to the success of the company. Who should design a process? The people who are already doing the work in an ad hoc manner. They know what needs to be communicated, and to whom. Naturally, they will be the right group to formalize the existing process and make it scalable. When should you start implementing processes? While that varies depending on your situation, keep in mind that it's much easier to add new people to old processes than new processes to old people. Formalize what you are doing to make it easy to onboard new people. Much has been written about process design, so I won't repeat that here. I have found The Basics of Production, the first chapter of Andy Grove's High Output Management, to be particularly helpful. For new companies, here are a few things to keep in mind. Focus on the output first. What should the process produce? In the case of the interview process, an outstanding employee. If that's the goal, what's the process to get there? Figure out how you'll know if you are getting what you want at each step. Are you getting enough candidates? Are you getting the right candidates? Will your interview process find the right person for the job? Once you select the person, will they accept the job? Once they accept the job, will they become productive? Once they become productive, will they stay with your company? How will you measure each step? Engineer accountability into the system. Which organization and which individual is responsible for each step? What can you do to increase the visibility of their performance? Final thought. The process of scaling a company is not unlike the process of scaling a product. Different sizes of company impose different requirements on the company's architecture. If you address those requirements too early, your company will seem heavy and sluggish. If you address those requirements too late, your company may melt down under the pressure. Be mindful of your company's true growth rate as you add architectural components. It's good to anticipate growth, but it's bad to over-anticipate growth. The Scale Anticipation Fallacy. The other day I was talking to a couple of friends of mine, one a VC and the other a CEO. During the meeting, we discussed one of the executives at the CEO's company. The executive in question performs exceptionally, but lacks experience managing at larger scale. My friend the VC innocently advised the CEO to carefully consider whether the executive would scale to meet the company's needs in the future. I responded swiftly, aggressively, and loudly, saying, "That's a horrible idea and makes no sense at all." Both of my friends were startled at my outburst. Normally, I am disciplined enough to refrain from letting my feelings pass straight through my mouth without stopping at my brain for review. Why the outburst? Here is my answer. As CEO, you must constantly evaluate all the members of your team. However, evaluating people against the future needs of the company based on a theoretical view of how they will perform is counterproductive for the following reasons. Managing at scale is a learned skill rather than a natural ability. Nobody comes out of the womb knowing how to manage 1,000 people. Everybody learns at some point. It's nearly impossible to make the judgment in advance. How do you tell in advance if an executive can scale? Was it obvious that Bill Gates would learn how to scale when he was a Harvard dropout? How do you go about making that decision? The act of judging people in advance will retard their development. If you make a judgment that someone is incapable of doing something, such as running a larger organization, will it make sense to teach them those skills or even point out the anticipated deficiencies? Probably not. You've already decided they can't do it. Hiring scalable execs too early is a bad mistake. There is no such thing as a great executive. There is only a great executive for a specific company at a specific point in time. Mark Zuckerberg is a phenomenal CEO for Facebook. He would not be a good CEO for Oracle. Similarly, Larry Ellison does a terrific job at Oracle, but he would not be the right person to manage Facebook. If you judge your team in advance and have a high sense of urgency, you will bring in executives who can manage at high scale in advance of needing them. Unfortunately, you will probably ignore their ability to do the job for the next 12 months, which is the only relevant measure. As a result, you will swap out good executives for worse ones. You still have to make the judgment at the actual point in time when you hit the higher level of scale. Even if you avoid the trap of hiring a scalable executive too early or retarding the new executive's development, you still haven't actually bought yourself anything by making the prejudgment. Regardless of what you decided at point in time A, you still have to evaluate the situation with far better data at point in time B. It's no way to live your life or run an organization. Deciding, with woefully incomplete data, that someone who works their butt off, does a terrific job, and loyally contributes to your mission won't be with you 3 years from now, takes you to a dark place. It's a place of information hiding, dishonesty, and stilted communication. It's a place where prejudice substitutes for judgment. It's a place where judgment replaces teaching. It's a place where teamwork becomes internal warfare. Don't go there. So if you don't prejudge people's ability to scale, how do you make the judgment? You should evaluate your team at least once a quarter on all dimensions. Two keys can help you avoid the scale anticipation trap. Don't separate scale from the rest of the evaluation. The relevant question isn't whether an executive can scale. It's whether the executive can do the job at the current scale. You should evaluate holistically, and this will prevent you from separating out scale, which often leads to an unwise prediction of future performance. Make the judgment on a relative rather than an absolute scale. Asking yourself whether an executive is great can be extremely difficult to answer. A better question: for this company, at this exact point in time, does there exist an executive who I can hire who will be better? If my biggest competitor hires that person, how will that impact our ability to win? Predicting whether an executive can scale corrupts your ability to manage, is unfair, and doesn't work. Chapter 7. How to lead, even when you don't know where you are going.
This for every ghetto in the hood. Nas the Don, Supercat the Don Dada, understood?
Nas, the Don. After selling the LoudCloud business to EDS, we immediately plunged into a new crisis. Our investors could not understand how selling all of our revenue and all of our customers could possibly leave us with anything worth investing in. As a result, Institutional investors sold all of their Opsware shares, and our stock price fell to 35 cents per share. This turned out to be a noteworthy price, because it computed to a market capitalization equal to half of the cash we had in the bank. This signaled that investors believed that the Opsware business had no value, and they further expected us to burn up half our cash before coming to our senses and returning the cash to investors. To make matters more miserable, I received a notice from NASDAQ informing me that if I did not get our stock price above $1 within the next 90 days, they would delist us, and we would trade with the penny stocks. I brought this cheery news to the board with three options. One, reverse split. We could reverse split the stock 10 to 1 and have 10 times fewer shares and a 10 times higher stock price. Two, give in. We could become a penny stock. Three, hit the road. I could go on the road and try to get enough people to buy so that the stock price would triple. The board was extremely sympathetic and open to every option. Andy Ratcliffe pointed out that the negative connotation with reverse splits among investors had lessened due to the sheer number of them. Mark hypothesized that being delisted in a post-newspaper economy might not matter so much. Still, I did not want to reverse split the stock. More than anything, it felt like a capitulation and a dramatic sign of weakness. Reverse splitting would say to the market that I believe we really were worth half the cash that we had in the bank. I also didn't want the company to get delisted. I knew that Mark would be right one day, but I also knew that many institutional investors were prohibited from buying penny stocks in the current day and age. I decided to hit the road. The first big question was, hit the road to go see whom? At that time, most institutional investors wouldn't invest in stocks with prices under $10, let alone under a dollar. So Mark and I called our networking guru, the famous angel investor Ron Conway, for advice. We told him the story, explaining that the $20 million a year EDS contract alone made the Opsware business worth something, and adding that we had a great team and a huge amount of intellectual property. So there was no reason for us to trade at half of cash. Ron listened carefully and then said, I think you should go see Herb Allen. I had heard about Herb's investment bank, Allen & Company, but didn't really know much about him. Allen & Company was famous for running the best business conference in the world. The conference is invitation only and consistently attracts guests whom you will never find at any other conference. People like Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and Rupert Murdoch are regulars. Allen & Company may attract more top-tier guests than all other business conferences combined. It's that good. Mark and I arrived at the Allen & Company office in Manhattan, located in the Coca-Cola building where Herb's father, Herbert, had served on the board of directors for many years. If a single word could describe the Allen & Company office, it would be classy, beautifully decorated, yet not flashy. The office was both elegant and comfortable. Like his office, Herb himself was both unassuming and classy. He opened the meeting by complimenting Ron, saying that any referral from Ron was personally important to him. Mark and I then carefully took Herb through the story of LoudCloud, how we had sold the services business to EDS, retaining the software and the key people, and had secured a $20 million a year software license. Beyond that, we had a totally clean balance sheet, and were surely worth more than 35 cents per share. Herb listened attentively to the entire presentation and then said, I'd like to be helpful. I'll see what I can do. I had no idea if he meant, as many in Silicon Valley would mean, screw off, I'm not buying a penny stock, or if he meant what he'd said. I soon found out. Over the next couple of months, Allen & Company bought Opsware stock. Herb Allen personally bought Opsware stock, and several Allen & Company clients became major investors. This activity propelled the stock from 35 cents to $3 per share in a matter of months. We'd avoided delisting, rebuilt the shareholder base, and given employees hope. Everything was largely due to a single meeting with Herb Allen. Years later, I asked Herb why he believed in our company at a time when nobody else did. I pointed out, at the time, Allen & Company wasn't very involved in technology, let alone data center automation. Herb replied, I didn't understand anything about your business, and I understood very little about your industry. What I saw was two guys come visit me when every other public company CEO and chairman was hiding under their desk. Not only did you come see me, but you were more determined and convinced you would succeed than guys running giant businesses. Investing in courage and determination was an easy decision for me. That's how Herb Allen does business. And that's why, if given the chance, you'd be a fool not to do business with Herb. Perhaps the most important thing that I learned as an entrepreneur was to focus on what I needed to get right and stop worrying about all the things that I did wrong or might do wrong. This section encapsulates the various parts of those lessons and provides guidance on how to get the important things right. The most difficult CEO skill. By far the most difficult skill I learned as CEO was the ability to manage my own psychology. Organizational design, process design, metrics, hiring and firing were all relatively straightforward skills to master compared with keeping my mind in check. I thought I was tough going into it, but I wasn't tough. I was soft. Over the years, I've spoken to hundreds of CEOs, all with the same experience. Nonetheless, very few people talk about it, and I have never read anything on the topic. It's like the Fight Club of management. The first rule of the CEO psychological meltdown is don't talk about the psychological meltdown. At the risk of violating the sacred rule, I will attempt to describe the condition and prescribe some techniques that helped me. In the end, this is the most personal and important battle that any CEO will face. If I'm doing a good job, why do I feel so bad? Generally, someone doesn't become a CEO unless she has a high sense of purpose and cares deeply about the work she does. In addition, a CEO must be accomplished enough or smart enough that people will want to work for her. Nobody sets out to be a bad CEO, run a dysfunctional organization, or create a massive bureaucracy that grinds her company to a screeching halt. Yet no CEO ever has a smooth path to a great company. Along the way, many things go wrong, and all of them could have and should have been avoided. The first problem is that everybody learns to be a CEO by being a CEO. No training as a manager, general manager, or in any other job actually prepares you to run a company. The only thing that prepares you to run a company is running a company. This means that you will face a broad set of things that you don't know how to do, that require skills you don't have. Nevertheless, everybody will expect you to know how to do them because, well, you are the CEO. I remember when I first became CEO, an investor asked me to send him the cap table. I had a vague idea of what he meant, but I didn't actually know what the format was supposed to look like or what should be included or excluded. It was a silly little thing, and I had much bigger things to worry about, but everything is hard when you don't actually know what you are doing. I wasted quite a bit of time sweating over that stupid spreadsheet. Even if you know what you are doing, things go wrong. Things go wrong because building a multifaceted human organization to compete and win in a dynamic, highly competitive market turns out to be really hard. If CEOs were graded on a curve, the mean on the test would be 22 out of 100. This kind of mean can be psychologically challenging for a straight-A student. It is particularly challenging because nobody tells you that the mean is 22. If you manage a team of 10 people, it's quite possible to do so with very few mistakes or bad behaviors. If you manage an organization of 1,000 people, it is quite impossible. At a certain size, your company will do things that are so bad that you never imagined that you'd be associated with that kind of incompetence. Seeing people fritter away money, waste each other's time, and do sloppy work can make you feel bad. If you are the CEO, it may well make you sick. And to rub salt into the wound and make matters worse, it's your fault. Nobody to blame. You can't blame jazz musicians or David Stern with his NBA fashion issues. Nas, hip-hop is dead. When people in my company would complain about one thing or another being broken, such as the expense reporting process, I would joke that it was all my fault. The joke was funny, because it wasn't really a joke. Every problem in the company was indeed my fault. As the founding CEO, every hire and every decision that the company ever made happened under my direction. Unlike a hired gun who comes in and blames all of the problems on the prior regime, there was literally nobody for me to blame. If someone was promoted for all the wrong reasons, that was my fault. If we missed the quarterly earnings target, that was my fault. If a great engineer quit, that was my fault. If the sales team made unreasonable demands on the product organization, that was my fault. If the product had too many bugs, that was my fault. It kind of sucked to be me. Being responsible for everything and getting a 22 on the test starts to weigh on your consciousness. Too much broken stuff. Given this stress, CEOs often make one of the following two mistakes. One, they take things too personally. Two, they do not take things personally enough. In the first scenario, the CEO takes every issue incredibly seriously and personally and urgently moves to fix it. Given the volume of the issues, this motion usually results in one of two scenarios. If the CEO is outwardly focused, she ends up terrorizing the team to the point where nobody wants to work at the company anymore. If the CEO is inwardly focused, she ends up feeling so sick from all the problems that she can barely make it to work in the morning. In the second scenario, in order to dampen the pain of the rolling disaster that is the company, the CEO takes a Pollyanna-ish attitude. It's not so bad. In this view, none of the problems is actually that bad, and they needn't be dealt with urgently. By rationalizing away the issues, the CEO feels better about herself. The problem is that she doesn't actually fix any of the problems, and the employees eventually become quite frustrated that the chief executive keeps ignoring the most basic problems and conflicts. Ultimately, the company turns to crap. Ideally, the CEO will be urgent, yet not insane. She will move aggressively and decisively without feeling emotionally culpable. If she can separate the importance of the issues from how she feels about them, she will avoid demonizing her employees or herself. It's a lonely job. In your darkest moments as CEO, discussing fundamental questions about the viability of your company with your employees can have obvious negative consequences. On the other hand, talking to your board and outside advisors can be fruitless. The knowledge gap between you and them is so vast that you cannot actually bring them fully up to speed in a manner that's useful in making the decision. You're all alone. At LoudCloud, when the dot-com bubble burst and subsequently sent most of our customers into bankruptcy, it crippled our business and devastated our balance sheet. Or rather, that was one interpretation. Another interpretation, and necessarily the official story for the company, was that we still had plenty of money in the bank and were signing up traditional enterprise customers at an impressive rate. Which interpretation was closer to the truth? In the absence of someone to talk to, that's a question that I asked myself about 3,000 times. As an aside, asking oneself anything 3,000 times turns out to be a bad idea. In this case, I had two specific difficult questions. One, what if the official interpretation was wrong? What if I was misleading everyone from investors to employees? In that case, I should be removed from my position immediately. Two, what if the official interpretation was right? What if I was grinding my brain into sawdust for no reason at all? What if I was taking the company off track by questioning my own direction? In that case, I should be removed from my position immediately. As is usually the case, there was no way to know which interpretation was right until much later. It turned out that neither was actually right. The new customers didn't save us, but we figured out another way to survive and ultimately succeed. The key to getting to the right outcome was to keep from getting married to either the positive or the dark narrative. My friend Jason Rosenthal took over as CEO of Ning in 2010. As soon as he became CEO, he faced a cash crisis and had to choose among three difficult choices. One, radically reduce the size of the company. Two, sell the company. Or three, raise money in a highly dilutive way. Think about those choices. 1. Lay off a large set of talented employees whom he worked very hard to recruit and, as a result, likely severely damaged the morale of the remaining people. 2. Sell out all of the employees whom he had been working side by side with for the past several years. Jason was promoted into the position by selling the company without giving them a chance to perform or fulfill their mission. 3. Drastically reduce the ownership position of the employees and make their hard work economically meaningless. Choices like these cause migraine headaches. Tip to aspiring entrepreneurs: if you don't like choosing between horrible and cataclysmic, don't become CEO. Jason sought advice from some of the best minds in the industry, but ultimately, he was completely alone in the final decision. Nobody had the answer. And whatever the answer, Jason was the one who had to live with the consequences. So far, his decision to reduce staff by letting go of primarily the most recent hires has paid off. Revenue at Ning is soaring, and team morale is high. If it had gone worse, or ultimately goes bad, it would be all Jason's fault, and it would be up to Jason to find a new answer. Whenever I see Jason, I like to say, "Welcome to the show." Jason eventually sold Ning to Glam and went on to become CEO of Lytro. At times like this, it's important to understand that nearly every company goes through life-threatening moments. My partner at Andreessen Horowitz, Scott Weiss, relayed that it's so common that there is an acronym for it, WFIO, which stands for "We're Fucked, It's Over." It's pronounced Wifio. As he describes it, every company goes through at least two, and up to five of these episodes, although I'm pretty sure that I went through at least a dozen at Opsware. In all cases, Wifios feel much worse than they are, especially for the CEO. Techniques to calm your nerves. The problem with psychology is that everybody's is different. With that as a caveat, over the years I developed a few techniques for dealing with myself. I hope you find them useful too. Make some friends. Although it's nearly impossible to get high-quality advice on the tough decisions that you make, it is extremely useful, from a psychological perspective, to talk to people who have been through similarly challenging decisions. Get it out of your head and onto paper. When I had to explain to my board that, since we were a public company, I thought that it would be best if we sold all of our customers and all of our revenue and changed business, it was messing with my mind. In order to finalize that decision, I wrote down a detailed explanation of my logic. The process of writing that document separated me from my own psychology and enabled me to make the decision swiftly. Focus on the road, not the wall. When someone learns to drive a race car, one of the first lessons taught is that when you are going around a curve at 200 miles per hour, do not focus on the wall. Focus on the road. If you focus on the wall, you will drive right into it. If you focus on the road, you will follow the road. Running a company is like that. There are always a thousand things that can go wrong and sink the ship. If you focus too much on them, you will drive yourself nuts and likely crash your company. Focus on where you are going rather than on what you hope to avoid. Don't punk out and don't quit. As CEO, there will be many times when you feel like quitting. I have seen CEOs try to cope with the stress by drinking heavily, checking out, and even quitting. In each case, the CEO has a marvelous rationalization about why it was okay for him to punk out or quit. But none of them will ever be great CEOs. Great CEOs face the pain. They deal with the sleepless nights, the cold sweats, and what my friend the great Albert Schwang, legendary co-founder and CEO of BEA Systems, calls the torture. Whenever I meet a successful CEO, I ask them how they did it. Mediocre CEOs point to their brilliant strategic moves or their intuitive business sense or a variety of other self-congratulatory explanations. The great CEOs tend to be remarkably consistent in their answers. They all say, "I didn't quit." The fine line between fear
and courage. I tell my kids, what is the difference between a hero and a coward? What is the difference between being yellow and being brave? No difference. Only what you do. They both feel the same. They both fear dying and getting hurt. The man who is yellow refuses.